Dr. Mascola, we almost didn't use the mic, but then I remember we're trying to record this, and we're not into silent videos here, so we will use the mic so it's recorded. Okay, so this is about financial freedom for your future. And here's a text for you, Proverbs 22:7. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. Okay? So we're going to go. Okay? The problem, probably for most students, is their student debt right now. Okay? But you're going to have other issues you're going to face. But when you come to school and you go sign up to register, and you get some student debt, it looks about like this. It looks like, you know, a roll of money, free money type thing. And at times, you may not see the trap. And then when you go to graduate, it feels like this, okay? So Vicki Thompson now is going to talk about student debt. Vicki is the Associate Director of Student Financial Services. No doubt many of you have met with her, okay? So Vicki is going to spend a few minutes talking about student debt.
Thank you, Steve. I'd just like to thank each and every one of you for coming and taking this event so seriously. It can really change your life. And I really like to thank Steve for giving me the opportunity to come and speak on this topic. As you know, I work in the student finance office, and my role is usually teaching you how to get a student loan. So I'm enjoying to have the opportunity to review and look at the topic of repaying your student loan and your student debt. Many of you, as you think about graduating, one of the questions you might have is, about those student loans you took, whether it was on the graduate level or the undergraduate level. So I just like to take the next few minutes and talk to you a little bit, and hopefully I can help answer some of those questions. When you think about repaying your debt, you might wonder, when do I repay those student loans? Well, every direct Stafford loan has a grace period. Your grace period is typically 6 months, and that grace period is 6 months after you stop attending school at least half-time or after you graduate. If you were fortunate enough to have a Perkins loan on the undergraduate level, you have a 9-month grace period for that loan. Repayment begins, as I mentioned, after you graduate or after you stop attending half-time. Circumstances that may change your grace period would be active military duty, returning to school. Some of you may be going on for doctoral studies or another master's degree, or loan consolidation. You might wonder, how long do I have to repay those student loans? Well, there's a variety of payment options, and you will have 10 to 25 years to repay those student loans. There are 6 different repayment options available to you right now. First, there's the standard repayment plan. That is the plan that you will pay the most per month, and you will have 10 years to repay that loan. You will pay less for that money if you select the standard plan, because you're going to pay more per month, but that means you'll pay less interest. There's the graduated repayment plan, and that may be a nice option for you because typically you'll pay less per month to start out making those payments, but then every 2 years as your income increases, your payment will increase. So you'll still have the 10 years. You will pay a little bit more interest, but it might be a nice way to get started. Next, there's the extended repayment plan. Payments are fixed or gradually. Your monthly payment will be lower than the standard plan, but you must have $30,000 in direct loan debt to qualify for that plan, and you will have 30 or 25 years to pay that loan. There's the income contingent repayment plan, and payments are calculated each year based on your gross income, family size, and your payments change as your income changes. And you'll have 25 years to repay that debt. There's also the IBR, which is a very popular plan that the government came out with a couple years ago, and it's called the Income-Based Repayment Plan. It's 15% of your discretionary income. Payments change as your income changes, and after making 25 years of monthly payments, if your loan is not paid off, it may be forgiven. And I have to use that word may because Congress enacted this, but if there is not money in the budget for the government at the time those loans, you've made those 25 years of repayment, who's to say that they're going to allow that to be written off? But one thing you need to realize with these plans, if they do write off that debt, you are going to receive a 1099, and say you had $5,000 left in unpaid debt that the government wrote off, you would pay tax on that money. Also, there's the pay-as-you-earn repayment plan. Payments are 10% of your discretionary income, and payments change as your income changes, and you have 20 years to make those payments. As well with that plan, you may have your debt written off after you make those monthly payments. Defaulted student loans, we definitely want to prevent you from going into default. Make sure that you're educated on your loans and your rights as a borrower. Make sure you take advantage of deferment and forbearance options that are available to you when you need them. Deferment is the temporary suspension of your monthly payment, and you usually are given up to 3 years. If you don't qualify for deferment, but are temporarily unable to make those payments, you may be eligible for forbearance. A forbearance also allows you to defer your loan payments in certain situations, such as illness. Interest does continue to accrue on your loans when you are in deferment and forbearance, so the loan does get bigger. Keep in mind that if you do go into default on a student loan, your IRS tax refund that you're used to getting can be garnished, and it will be garnished from the federal level and the state level. It's possible. And so it's always important to stay in touch with your lender if you're not able to make a payment, so your status doesn't go that way. And another thing I'd like to mention, you know, it may be a couple years from now that you go out there to purchase a home. If you have defaulted student loans, you most likely will be denied a home loan because you have a defaulted student loan. So keep that loan in good standing. There was one other thing I wanted to say about that. Another item. I recently had a phone call from a former MDiv student about 2 weeks ago, and now some employers are running credit checks on their potential employee. And this former student told me that he was qualified for the job and he thought he would get the job, but they told him he had a negative credit record and it was due to his defaulted student loan. So now, instead of not thinking about it after a number of years, he wanted to get those loans back in good status, so that way he would be eligible for employment opportunities. So you do have options available to you as a borrower. Please take advantage of them. Loan consolidation. This is one way to rehabilitate your loans. Everybody is offered the opportunity to consolidate their loans at least once over the life of your loan. If you have multiple student loans from undergrad and grad level, it may be nice to consolidate and then just have one monthly payment. It makes things a little simpler, if you will say. But you have to remember there are trade-offs in each situation, so make sure you research that. One of the potential trade-offs is if you decide I'm going to consolidate my loans the moment I graduate, you may lose your grace period. So in that case, it may not, if you're not ready to pay the moment you graduate, it may be wise to wait a few months before you process your consolidation. And if you want to consolidate a defaulted loan, you have to make repayment arrangements with your loan servicer or repay your new agree to repay your new consolidated loan under income contingent or income-based repayment plans. Public loan forgiveness. Many of you may have heard about this. If you're employed in certain public service sector jobs and you have made 120 payments on or after your loan after October 1, 2007, the remaining balance of your loan may be forgiven. The reason may is the same thing. Congress has voted it, but there's going to have to be room in the budget. If you work for any government organization, you would qualify for that. If you work for a 501(c) not-for-profit, which is the church. But one thing you need to realize with that is you have to work 30 hours of full-time work or multiple part-time jobs that equal 30 hours, but any hours that you spend conducting worship services, proselytizing, or worship instruction would not be counted in that 30-hour limit. So that's something you have to keep in mind. Remember, you want to know what you owe and who you owe. So to find out who you owe, you may go to studentloans.gov or NSLDS, and you can run a loan history. If you log on to studentloans.gov, there's a wealth of information there for you. Please take advantage of the website. You can click on Repayment Estimator, and you can compare different repayment options as it relates to you. If you're going to miss a payment, be sure and contact your lender, and be sure and keep your credit in good standing. I've just put one slide together to show you the amount of money you may owe on a different payment plan. So, for instance, if you had an aggregate debt of $25,000, on the standard repayment plan, you would pay $307 monthly. If you were on the extended, you would pay $213 monthly. On the graduated, it would be $172. And on the income contingent, it would be $102. So many of you may think $102 sounds a whole lot better to me. But you have to really pull apart the numbers and see. If you take the income contingent and you pay $102 monthly over the life of that loan, you're going to pay back $52,000. So it may be to your advantage to be on a standard payment plan, and then you'll only have paid back $36,000. So you really want to look at the fine details when you're looking at repaying those student loans. The next slide is just loan servicers. When the government took over the direct lending program, and now all loans are administered by them, they spread out people's loan payments to loan servicers. So probably about 4 months after you graduate, you're going to get a letter in the mail from one of these 11 lenders. You're going to want to be sure and get in touch with them, because graduation is a time where people frequently are changing addresses and moving. You'll want them to know where you're living so you can be in communication with them. And before I turn this back to Steve, I would just like to let you know I have some handouts up front that gives these numbers and that on paper if you want to take them with you, so you would know how to reach any potential lender you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Vicki. Okay, and we will have, we plan to have time at the end for questions, okay? Okay. Okay, so what does debt really cost? Okay, we're going to talk about this. Notice you start out with debt, and the debt becomes, you know, like change you down, and pretty much next thing, the next exit is bankruptcy, okay, which I personally don't believe is a moral option in most cases. But we're going to talk about what debt really costs you. I'm going to use this as an example. Credit card, okay? Assume that you routinely carry a $5,560 balance on your credit card or cards, okay? You just pretty much have $5,560. You charge some, you pay some. That's what you carry, okay? Year after year. Your credit card is 18% interest. You may be able to get credit cards lower than that. I know you can. There are credit cards that are higher than that, okay? So $5,560 times 18% is $1,000 a year, okay? So we've established that. That's just suppose, okay? So if you pay $1,000 per year, in 5 years, you're going to pay $5,000. 10 years, $10,000. 20, 30. Your whole working life, okay? You're done with seminary. You start working at age, 26, 27. You work for 40 years till you're 67. You retire. You've paid out $40,000 in interest for the privilege of using $5,560 that was not yours. Is that a good investment? Okay. So, that's just an example of what debt costs. I mean, if you start adding it up, debt is very expensive. Okay? But then think about this. What about the opportunity that you missed because you were paying credit card interest of $1,000 a year? Okay? What if you had invested that $1,000 per year? You said, no, I'm not carrying a balance. I'm investing it. Second column, you invest it, you earn no interest, but you still have the money. At the end of 40 years, you have $40,000. The third column, what if you could earn 5% consistently? At the end of 40 years, you could have $120,000. The fourth column, what if you could earn 10%? Some people say, oh, you can never earn 10%. Well, maybe, maybe not. The stock market historically has made 10% over the last 100 years. I'm not going to be naive and say that it's going to make 10% over the next 100 years, okay? I think the world is changing. But still, what if you did earn 10%? $442,000. Okay? Just by putting $1,000 a year away. So let's just spend a few minutes, okay? I'm not a trained pastor or theologian, so I'm going to do a little bit of proof texting, okay? Let's spend a few minutes. What does the Bible say about possessions, money, and debt? Okay, number one, I'm going to have four slides. This is number one. God is the owner of everything, okay? It's all his, the land, the silver, the beasts, everything is God's, okay? So let's establish that. God is the owner of everything. Number two, we are his stewards. Okay? A few texts. The parable of the talents and the Son of Man coming to judge the nations. Okay? How did we use the talents God gave us on earth? This text. Consider us servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. I know I'm misapplying this a little bit. Okay? But he requires that servants be found faithful. And then the parable of the unjust steward. You know, when the ruler came back, he expected, or when he checked on him, he expected that he was faithful and wise, okay? And the unjust steward, actually God commended him, okay? But he was mismanaging his money. So the bottom line is we are stewards or managers of the assets that God has loaned us while we're on earth. So we need to manage them well, like God would expect us to, like God would manage them, okay? So God is the owner. We are his steward or manager. Now the next two are about debt. And the Bible gives warnings against debt, okay? Several warnings against debt. Owe no man anything except love. The next one, we started off with this, the rich rules over the poor. And then Do not be, I like this one, do not be one of those who shakes hands in a pledge, one of those who is surety for debts. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should he take your bed from under you? In other words, if you don't have money to buy something now, don't promise that you're going to, because you're probably not going to have money then. Okay? And you're going to lose your bed to sleep on. Okay? But you say, well, I'm already in debt. What do I do now? Okay? Well, that's simple. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Or as I put it, simply do what you said you were going to do. If you promised that you would pay a loan, pay the loan. The wicked borrows and does not repay, but the righteous shows mercy and gives. So this is really boils down to integrity. Okay? Following through and doing what you say you are going to do. Okay? So, let me give you a couple key words. Contentment. This is a very important word. It's being satisfied with what you are managing for God, what you have. It doesn't negate a desire and ambition to improve, but it's an attitude of gratitude. You're satisfied with what you're at, where you're at, because that's where God has put you. It doesn't say that you may not have a desire to improve, but yet in your present situation, you're content. Okay? And self-control. I think these are two important words when it comes to money management and debt. Self-control is really giving God control. Okay? That's what self-control is. It's not controlling yourself. It's giving God control over your life and finances and being willing to say no to some things so you can say yes to some better things later on, whether it's in this life or in heaven, okay? So contentment and self-control, I love these words. Now we're going to look at a pastor's budget. This is somewhat fictitious, but it's close to reality, okay? Everyone's going to be a little different. Okay, I've tried to make this as real as I can. Starting wage for a starting pastor out of seminary, I'm going to take a stab at $42,000. It may be a little more, maybe a little less, okay? Unfortunately, it's becoming more prevalent that graduates of the seminary will get a stipend position, and that is typically about half of this, maybe, with no benefits. Yeah, if that, with no benefits, okay? It's kind of like, come on, we'll employ you as a part-time pastor, but you're probably going to work full-time, you know? Okay, so that may be good or bad, and let me explain. It gets your foot in the door, okay? Gets your foot in the door, but it doesn't necessarily pay the bills really well. So it works well most often. Let's say you're married and your spouse also works, okay? It works well there. It also works well, let's say you're single and you can live like a student. You can keep living like a student. You rent a little apartment or a room or whatever. It works well to get your foot in the door, and then hopefully within a couple years or so, if you do well, they're going to offer you a full-time position, okay? What I'm talking about here is a full-time position, not a stipend position. Okay. So starting wage, I'm going to take an estimate of $42,000. You're going to pay 10% tithe, 10% offerings. So that's $42,000 times 10 plus another 10 or $8,400. You're certainly going to pay self-employment tax. A pastor pays both sides. Right now, you're thinking Social Security, 7.65%. A pastor is self-employed, so they pay 7.65 times 2, or 15.3%. It's your responsibility to pay that. Your conference will not automatically deduct all your taxes out. You have to set it up, either make quarterly estimated payments, or in many instances, the conferences will actually take it out for you, but you have to initiate and ask them to do that, okay? So that's $6,400. Federal and state taxes, I'm estimating to be almost $5,000. So you take 42 minus 84 minus 64 minus 48, and you end up with $22,000 left to pay your bills on. Okay? Divide that by 12, almost $1,900 a month. So let's look at what a $1,900 a month wage looks like. Okay. I'm putting these percentages right up here. These are based on somewhat of like financial counselor standard percentages that they think people should be able to spend for these categories. So housing, 32%, so basically a third, $600 basically. That's not only your rent, but that's your utilities too, okay? I know. Hang with me, okay? I'm making a point. Okay. Okay, food. I showed this to my wife, and she said, you can't live on $242 a month in food. Okay? Auto, this is payments, repairs, gas, insurance. Okay? If you have payments, that's not going to work. Family vacation, this is kind of the catch-all. Vacation, clothes, recreation, cell phone, you know, all the smaller expenses, they add up. Okay? Almost $500 a month. Medical. Debt and savings, okay? So Vicki just showed you, if you know you owe X amount of dollars in student debt, and she just showed you what your payment may be, it's very likely that many of you in here, that $93 isn't going to make it. So you know what's going to happen? The savings isn't going to be there, and some of these are going to be increased, and you're going to be living on credit cards. Is that really what's going to happen? Okay, unless you really, right up front, plan out your budget, make wise choices of where you're going to live, what you're going to drive, and how you're going to spend it. Okay, that's why we're having this seminar today, is to help you make good choices right up front, instead of a year after you leave here and your loan's kicked in at 6 months. And a year later, this isn't working, okay? So we want to help you make good choices. Okay? So first problem, student debt. Second problem, auto debt. Okay? So you decide. You decide, okay? Okay. So you're going to decide, but your decision isn't which car you buy. Your decision is going to be these up here. Decide to keep your existing car longer. Okay, the average person, every 3-4 years, they're updating their car. Keep your car longer. Pay your auto loan off as fast as you can. And when you get to the end of that, you make your last payment, then you start putting what you were paying into a savings account. Every month. Okay, you don't do it only the months where you have extra money. That is a bona fide amount that you make sure that you put in your savings, okay? Then for your next auto purchase, use your saved up car money and the sale of your existing car that you're getting rid of, that you're trading in or getting rid of, towards the purchase of a good used car, okay? And if that's not enough, then finance your next car short term, 12 to 24 months, start the process all over again, okay? So after a car or two, you should get to the point where you're making the payments to yourself and then you're paying cash for the car. You can get a lot better deal when you're paying cash. You're going to save the interest and you're going to feel a whole lot better about yourself, and your family budget is going to work a lot better, okay? But that doesn't mean you don't make car payments, but you make them to yourself. Okay? And, I can't miss this. And auto debt does not have to be a way of life. Reggie. I, We could talk about that at the end, but I would caution unless someone is really experienced about buying cars at an auction. Yeah, well, there are some public auctions, but this is what I've found. Generally, the cars at the more local auctions that are on the cheaper end or maybe even in the middle are ones that good dealerships have taken as a trade-in, and they don't necessarily want to sell them, and there's a reason. So I would be very leery of just saying, oh, yeah, get a car to auction. It's going to be a good deal. Okay? You have to be experienced. Okay? So if you're going to do that, maybe you buddy up with a mechanic that can help you, okay? But auto debt does not have to be a way of life. Okay. The next problem, home purchase. Okay, I'm giving you a lot of information. I'm just trying to give you like an overview so that over the next few years as you graduate and move on, maybe you say, oh yeah, I remember something about this, and it'll help you make a better decision. I'm not giving you complete information. We don't have time for that. Should I buy or should I rent? Let me give you a few tips. Don't buy unless you are sure you will be living in that house for 5+ years. Okay? Because over the last 5-6 years, almost nationwide, the price of houses has been stagnant or going down. So let's say that 5-6 years ago, you bought a house for $100,000. It's very likely, depending on the market you're in, it's only worth $60,000, $70,000, or $80,000 now. Okay? So you buy a house, new pastor, you buy a house, 3 years later, the conference wants you to move to a different pastorate. You can't sell your house and get your money out of it. Okay? So there are people that actually cannot move because they can't sell their house. To sell their house, they're going to have to write a check for $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, okay? So my recommendation is you do not buy a house, especially when you first leave the seminary, until you know that you're going to be somewhere for at least 5 years, okay? And then once you've crossed that hurdle, you don't jump in and buy one. You don't do a house hunting visit and buy one on a weekend. Or online, yes. Okay? I'm recommending you actually go there, move there, rent something, especially for your first house. Get used to the area so you can make a good, informed decision. Okay? Because where you go and visit, when you go on a weekend, do a house hunting trip and visit, where you think might be the perfect place to live, once you've lived there for 6 months or a year, you might think, oh, I'm sure glad we didn't buy a house in that area because I don't want to live there. The commute's too long, you know, whatever, okay? And then ideally, this is the ideal in my opinion, and I would like you to strive for the ideal, put a full 20% down. So you're going to buy a house for $100,000, you're going to put $20,000 down. You have saved up that money, and you're going to put it down. What that does is if the price of houses do drop and you need to move, it gives you a lot more cushion. You might lose money, but you could sell the house for, you know, $85,000 or whatever and actually walk away, okay? If you put 3% down of $100,000, $3,000, and the house drops in value to $85,000, you're going to have to pay $10,000 to get out of it. You're not going to have the $10,000, I can guarantee, unless you've saved it up and then apply it. Plus, there is special insurance that has to be bought if the loan to home value is less, how do I say this, is more than 80%. If you get a 90% or a 95% or a 98% loan, you have to pay insurance to the bank, and that is substantial, like at least $100 a month for the rest of your loan, okay? So you can avoid that cost and be in a lot better position. Get a 15-year loan, not a 30-year loan, okay? We're going to talk about this in the next slide. This is my favorite example of home buying. Okay? We're going to talk about the biggers and the smallers. This isn't someone newly out of seminary, okay? The biggers want to buy a $200,000 house. In Berrien Springs, a $200,000 house is a pretty good house, okay? They have the ability to borrow $200,000. So in both examples, it's a 7% interest. You actually can buy a house, a first mortgage, if you have good credit for around 5 right now. My wife and I, when we bought our home that we still live in 29 years ago, newly out of college, we paid 13% interest in 1985, okay? So don't say, oh, 7%, you know. The interest could go back up, okay? 7% interest, they will sign a loan agreement for 30 years. Their payment is $1,330 a month for 30 years, and they're going to pay for that $200,000 house $479,000 over the life of the 30 years, okay? But the smallers, they are smart people, and they say, we can afford that $1,331 a month payment, but we don't want it. We don't need that big house, but you know what we're going to do? We're going to buy a small house, but we're going to pay the $1,331 a month, okay? In 8 years, that house is paid off. And they own the $100,000 house. And in 8 years, the biggers still owe $178,000. They have paid off only $11,008. Or is it 18? $11,018. And the smallers have made the exact same payment. They have not paid one penny more, and they own a $100,000 house. Okay? Then at that point, the smallers say, okay, our family is growing. We need the bigger house. We're going to sell the small house. I'm assuming inflation is stagnant, okay? It's not. They're going to sell it for $100,000, but by then, maybe it's worth $140,000 or $50,000. I don't know. They're going to sell it. They're going to use that as a 50% down payment on the same house they could have bought 8 years before. And so they're going to finance another $100,000. Now it may be more because of inflation. They're going to finance another $100,000 and start over again, $1,331 a month for another 8 years. And at the end of 16 years, with the exact same payment, they own the house. That the biggers, look right here, still owe $142,000 on. It's 16 years. They have not paid one dime more. But what they did was they saved all the interest on that second $100,000. They only paid interest on the first $100,000, and they shortened the term up, and so they saved all the interest, okay? So they own the same house, and look right over here. They've paid $261,000 for a $200,000 house that the biggers with the same payment still owe $142,000 on. Okay? So, they started out, they started out with the little house. But then the cool thing is, they said, you know what? This is kind of like the car payment. We're used to that $1,331 a month payment. We're going to start putting that in a savings account. If they could put in a savings account that earned 6% interest over the next 14 years, okay, they would have not only the big house, but $223,000 in their account as they paid out the exact same amount per month as the biggers, and they own the bigger house. Okay? So here, look at the biggers. At 8 years, out of $200,000, they owe $179,000. 16 years, once the smallers have actually bought the big house and paid it off, they owe $142,000. Another 8 years later, $78,000, and finally, they get to zero at 30 years. And the people that started with a small house have the big house and 223,000. Now, it may not work out that way for you, but I'm giving you that principle. Okay? Okay, principles of borrowing. This is not just for houses, this is for cars, education, anything, okay? Use debt only to purchase items that will produce an income or appreciate in value. This is my personal principle of borrowing. So that negates credit cards, it negates automobiles, it negates furniture, appliances, student loan. Oh, I didn't say that, did I? Okay. The only thing that I personally will borrow on is a house. Borrow as little as possible. Always make a substantial down payment so the loan balance never exceeds the value of the item. This is prevalent in automobile debt, okay? You trade in your $2,000 or $3,000 car on the new car, you drive it off the lot, it loses $5,000 or $6,000 because a week later it's used, but you owe more than that because you only put $2,000 or $3,000 down. And for the next several years, it doesn't get any better, okay? Pay it back as soon as possible to save the interest. The payment must not cause undue strain on the family budget. And the husband and wife must both agree to the purchase and the loan. If only one of the spouses wants it and the other one says, no, I'm not sure about it, that's a good indication, don't do it. Okay? This is the example of the biggers and the smallers. Under buy. Only buy the quality item that is needed to get the job done. A 2 or 3 bedroom home compared to a 4 bedroom. A used auto compared to a new auto. A Honda versus a Hummer, okay? So you only buy the quality. I'm not saying buy cheap. I'm saying buy quality that you need to get the job done. And be content. Conclusions, and then we're going to have questions. Keep living like a student when you graduate and pay all of your debt off. I'm talking about your student loans, but if you have anything else, okay, live like a student. Now, I will admit there are some students that I'm not sure are living like students. What I'm saying is live like a student really should live like, okay? Live frugal, okay? Next one, always spend less than you earn. That way you will only need to borrow for a home, okay? That's exactly the margin, okay? You've got to have margin in there. Third one, if you continue to have an overspending problem, admit that the problem is you. It's not your lack of knowledge, the problem is you. And then ask yourself, what will it take to motivate me to change? And this is my goal. If one person here today makes a change, then the goal has been accomplished. And I want to challenge you, that one person may be you. Okay? Maybe it'll be several one persons. But I want to challenge you to personally think about what you've heard today and make a change. Okay? Any questions? And we can have, okay, this is what I'm going to do. Alex, are you up there? Okay, I'm going to bring the mic to you. You ask the question, then we'll answer. No, just shout out the question. Right here first. Okay. So he was missing 15 years too, okay? But he came up with a plan and he's working the plan. Your best investment is in yourself, okay? And let me explain. I had some friends that it was a second marriage. They both owned houses. They sold one, they bought a house, got a loan on it, and then they had the second house they fixed up and put up for sale. This was just before the housing crash. Okay, they sold the second house, and they said to me, because they netted, I think it was about $100,000 out of the house. They said, somebody said we should invest this in mutual funds in the stock market because it's doing really well. What do you think? And I said, your best investment is in yourself. And they said, what do you mean? I said, pay down, pay off your existing home loan. That's your safest investment because it's dependent upon what you do. So I asked them about 3 or 4 years later, after the stock market had gone way down, I said, what did you do? And they said, thank goodness we paid down on our house. Because if they had put it in the stock market, the $100,000, and then it went to worth $50,000, okay? So the best investment is in yourself, paying off your own loans, okay, initially. Question. Okay, so you're questioning from a personal standpoint, will life continue as is, I think is what I'm hearing from a pastor's perspective. Well, okay, the best thing is when you buy a house, short loan, okay? You get a 30-year loan, you saw in 8 years, it only was reduced by $11,000, okay? Whereas if you buy smaller, pay more aggressively, you not only in 8 years do the smallers own the home, but at 4 years, they don't own quite half of it, but they own a whole lot more than what the big people owned. And so you can recover a lot quicker with the less amount of debt. So if you make a pact with your spouse or yourself that you're not going to borrow anything except for a home loan and you're going to do that in shorter terms, 15 years, and pay it off faster, you know, you're a lot safer and more nimble to move. Or, you know, let's face it, okay, part of it is you want to be able to do what God wants you to. If you're in this job and you feel really impressed that you need to be going to this job, but you can't sell your house, okay? So be nimble, be low on what you owe, small amount, pay it off faster, then you're a lot safer, okay? Okay.